You're listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 369.
And welcome back to theoutdoorstation.co.uk with me, your host, Bob Cartwright. And this, the second or fourth part, depending on how you want to look at it, of my interview with Warren and Esther Sanders, who are currently cycling around the world. This conversation takes place just before they set out Easter 2014 on the last leg of their journey across the US back to the UK. They've now been on the road cycling around the world for some 3+ years. And if this is the first time you've stumbled across this podcast, then I suggest you listen to number 339 and 340, which I did with them when they were a year into their trip. And then the preceding one to this, 368, which I recorded last week. Of course, all the links to their blog site, the Smart Wall Diaries, can be found on theoutdoorstation.co.uk under this particular podcast number, along with any photos, etc., etc. So please check us out there, and while you're there, if you've got time, do have a look at the other 360-odd free podcasts, which are all available, all relating to self-powered travel. Now, a lot of listeners have emailed and said they hope to be coming along and supporting us at the first Backpacking Light Lightweight Outdoor Show, which takes place in Malvern the following weekend, next weekend, the 26th of April 2014. Do come and say hi if you're a podcast fan. Hopefully, a lot of people involved with the Outdoor Station will be there, including Andy Howell, who will no doubt be drinking endless cups of tea and talking all about lightweight gear to anyone who wants to listen. Of course, full details, the location, the maps, and details of the nearby camping site can be found on the backpackinglight.co.uk website under the tab which says Outdoors Show. Don't forget, of course, the best pie shop in the world is just down the road, next to the pub and duck pond and village green. It's a cute place. So let's now pick up with Warren and Esther once again, where we look at the wild camping laws around the world. What about the wild camping rules in all the different countries that you've been to? I mean, you've, as you say, it sounds like you sort of surreptitiously wait till dark and then quickly erect your shelter and obviously sort yourself out and disappear first thing in the morning. But did you ever find a rule of thumb that would work for you as regards what was the correct legality in wild camping?
Most of the places we've been through, it's illegal, whether it's stated or not. Our favourite tree was the olive tree, all the way through Europe. In the UK, if you don't know if you're going into a field, if it's a sheep field, the possibilities of being found or stumbled upon are quite high. Cows twice a day, olives get touched twice a year. And every time we saw olive trees, we cheered up and we basically headed to the nearest olive grove for the evening. And nobody really minded. We had such good fun and such great places. And it's far easier than you could ever imagine.
But in terms of trying to find a good spot, it was always out of or away from a settlement, so that you wouldn't have the dogs coming towards you or the noise of the people. You yourself don't want to be, in somebody's backyard, unless you're obviously invited. So it was very often between a little forest and a field.
Yeah, quite often I'd flick on the GPS and have a look if there's a forest nearby or a river, and we'd just head towards that if we were looking for wild camp spots.
I mean, you know, obviously, in the UK, and presumably most of Europe as well, it's the one thing that if you know you're going to be wild camping, it always fills you with a sort of a hesitant dread during the day. And as the evening draws closer, where can I go?
The strange thing this year, because we've been coming through very hot temperatures, we've been camping, wild camping with just the bug net, and got used to the fact that we could see out and we could hear. If we hear a noise overnight, we could quite quickly work out if it was a problem or wasn't a problem, if it was a dog just walking by. As soon as we had a cooler weather and we had to put the fly sheet on and we didn't have that straight line of sight overnight, we felt more insecure. The fact that being able to see was a great help, and that really affected us. As the first few nights we had the bug net covered, basically with a rain fly, we were nervous.
It's strange, that, isn't it? I mean, I've certainly found that when just going out in a bivy bag and a tarp, though actually once you've done that, when you return to a tent again, your imagination starts to play all sorts of tricks on you.
Yeah, and if you haven't experienced that and being able to see the stars. Just the joy of watching satellites. We got very much into watching the International Space Station go over. Was almost one of the highlights of the trip, seeing something quite so big and quite so obvious fly over you. You do miss it. And I think going back, I'm not sure we're a cave-dwelling people. I'm sure we were out. We get too nervous. And I think that's deep within you genetically. You want to hear things and you want to be able to see very quickly and assess things overnight if it's a problem or not.
Personal safety is obviously of high importance. Personal safety and also awareness of the value of your goods and your technology and so on. And we get very, very sold on the idea of being so overprotective about all this stuff and wrapping it in wire, blooming encased bags and this, that and the other. How would you describe, in the 3 years that you have been travelling, your concerns over safety and your equipment and so on? Have you had any moments where you were really concerned that you're going to lose something?
Absolutely none. We always think our way of assessing the danger levels are, does this feel more dangerous than what we know at home? Quite often the answer is no. We feel part of where we live and know very well. When you look, where am I now? You do calm down. We've never come anywhere near to having any sort of aggression at us, while camping or not. People are just normally quite thrilled that you're bothering to stay near their village.
And I mean, it has to be said, you know, when you go around, we are two people. I mean, very often, you disappear into, let's say, a church to have a look at the interior. We do have a lock on us, and we do lock the bikes, and we also try to trust our instincts. So whenever you feel like this bike is not at a proper place, we can't see it, and this doesn't feel right, we will take more precautions. For instance, put it in the sight of your vision if you go somewhere, or you simply have somebody staying outside and the other one is just watching, is going into the building. But at night, because if you do camp, so the options are you camp wild or you camp at a campsite. At least this is what happened to us. And when you're wild, you don't want to be seen. So your stuff, you don't want to have that being seen either. So that feels quite safe. And the campsites, you just hope that the people on the campsite are honest people there. I think the most problems where you feel worried about your equipment is when you put it into a flight bag and fly to a different continent or fly out. Waiting for the arrival of your bicycle or your bags to come, then I think it's the most anxious moment about your stuff.
certainly I think I found in my travelling experience and all the family is that when, as you say, you let go of your bag and you're on a coach or whatever, and then they sling it on the top of the rack or they put it in the underside of the coach, you're never too sure when it's taken off, especially if it's a night coach and it stops three or four times during the night and people are removing various bags, whether yours has disappeared. But I've not actually heard, in all honesty, of a story of that actually happening. It's just a fear that plays on your mind.
Yeah.
We in hotels, we would always ask, can we take our bikes into our room? And if we couldn't do that and the options weren't good, we'd move on to the next hotel, because that was an absolute requirement. We must be able to sleep without worrying about where our bikes are. But the whole trip, if you worry about your equipment, you don't enjoy the trip. So we've trusted people and kind of hope that they don't realize quite the total value of this thing is that's sitting there on two wheels.
Well, also when you go into hotels, a lot of the people realize that this is your mode of transport, and they're quite happy to give you ease of mind and put, if you can't take the bike into your room, then very often they've got a storage room where you can actually leave the bike. I mean, a lot of people are very, very accommodating, and that's quite reassuring, actually.
I think what I like about your trip is that everything, we're looking at the website as we're talking here, you have made the most of the diversions.
All the way through this year, other than visas, we've almost done no planning. We plan on a day-to-day basis. We get the map out, look at the three possible towns that we could head for, and if we've got internet access, we'll put the name of the town in, go on to images, and if we like the images of the town, and if the first two dozen images are not of an industrial estate, basically we'll head towards the nicest looking town and work it out on a day to day basis. The lack of planning is part of the way we do it.
The Outdoors Station is a free media entertainment service dedicated to the self-powered outdoors enthusiast.
You said in the previous interview how difficult the trip would have been if you didn't take along your treasured little Mac laptop. It sounds like you've really used the technology on a very, very regular basis. And I suppose what I'm leading to in the question is, if you hadn't got the technology, if somebody decided to go travelling and do a similar trip to this without the GPS, without the mobile phone and without a computer, do you think it'd be possible to do it?
Yes, but it's a lot more difficult. We thought it would be easy, and we thought we're probably taking too much. But so even all the way through Asian countries and what the GPS came into its own because of signposts are not in English, so the GPS was wonderful. Quite often we'd sit the MacBook down and we would have Google Translate running to try to communicate with people. So we had really nice conversations with people in China just by typing out, and felt very, very, very warm and friendly feelings through the technology.
The technology makes it easier, but you still can get around. Western Europe is probably a bit more difficult, because when you go into towns and you don't know where you can stay, and you've got several options. I mean, we found, for instance, that you get a far better deal on the internet, and you also see, you know, what's around in terms of accommodation. You get a better deal through the internet than turning up on the desk that very day. So you actually, sometimes it actually saves your money as well. But it's not actually inhibiting to get out there and not have any of the conveniences, let's say. I mean, the technology we use is good for several reasons. A, to get around, specifically the GPS, or if you have to make your mind, or want to make your mind up if you want to go to town A or town B. The other thing is, because we're on the road for so long, it is actually quite important for us to stay in contact with people. And doing that through the internet, I mean, that's the tool to use. You can't really get postcards in most places anymore. The letters, actually, post stamps become pretty expensive. And email and Facebook and whatever is out there is actually the tool to keep connected to the people that have actually been very nice to you. So if you don't mind, you know, not having that, then yes, you can do it, but it will be a bit harder.
Yeah, we've resorted to paper and pen and doodles as well, so it's not all high tech.
A MacBook Air that you've got, and a GPS, and I presume a phone. Have you got a phone?
Yeah, the phone's just there for emergency back. Occasionally just checking emails on that, and they have been wonderful. They have absolutely been wonderful, and it's not difficult to use them now. We never once got solar panels to work properly for us, but really there's far more plugs in the world than you would ever imagine.
Mm. And also coming back to the telephone, I mean, we don't have a high-tech telephone because most of the communication that we do happens actually through the computer. But the phone as an emergency tool to actually call somebody is rather important. And in most countries, what we do that we get a pay-as-you-go card, and we've got an unlocked phone. And that is actually very, very helpful. Even now that we are in the United States, we managed to get a pay-as-you-go SIM card that's slotted into the phone that we actually bought in Germany. So that is working pretty fine. And a lot of people, when we're using, for instance, warm showers, and we'll again use it far more here in the States because it's so widely available, but very often people leave a telephone number to be contacted and almost expect you to call them. So you, in a way, you do need a telephone to say, you know, can I come and stay with you? We arrive at that and that time.
The budget that you referred to in our previous interview, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, was it about £1,000 a month, you were saying?
Yeah, it's £1,000. So some weeks feel like that you're just running away with the budget and you're just going to spend more than you could ever imagine. But always within a few weeks, you come across a week where you've hardly managed to spend anything. So, yeah, it works out about £1,000 or just over per month. So for two people, I think that's a pretty good lifestyle.
I was just curious to know whether you'd actually stuck to it, that was all.
I think in sort of Western, Southwestern Europe. So we're talking about Italy, Switzerland, Austria. These countries are actually fairly expensive. And I think if you would look into our monthly spending, you would be quite a bit higher per person. But that is set off by the lower prices when you go through Slovenia, or when you come through the Baltic states. So it's always a balance.
Now let's start to wind this up a bit now. There's a few questions here that I'd certainly like to ask you. You just touched on the Warm Showers website. That's obviously been a great assistance to you, and certainly in the US, as you say, it's a very common service to use. I think you said actually when you return home, you're going to throw the doors open to people that are travelling your way when you come back. But have you made contact at any very, very unusual places outside the US using the warm showers?
Yeah, we had one of our best warm showers in Laos, strangely enough.
Really?
So that was if you understand the concept of couch surfing, warm showers is couch surfing for cycle tourists. And we've used couch surfing, but people get a. I'm on the 15th floor of a tower block. Is that a problem? Well, yeah, actually, it is with this bike. So with warm showers, people expect you to turn up with a bike, and they're wonderful. Warm showers. I think Laos is the
weirdest
but nice.
We stayed with one warm showers host in Slovenia, which was just a wonderful experience. We're still good friends with those people.
Yeah, other than we broke our rule and had to plan to be at a certain point and dialed that into Google Map, and it said something like 60 miles, where the true distance was 110 miles. So we ended up turning up because we had a place to stay in the dark. And the first person we asked for directions gave us wine. So we ended up drunk and cycling in the dark. And then had more wine when we got there. So it's a kind of lost day. Yeah, lovely people.
What, all the different countries you've been through, just very, very briefly, if you can sweep through this, I'm curious to know what the simple pleasure has been in each country or each sort of group of countries.
I think bread.
Bread
throughout the world is a thing that gets you straight into the culture of that area.
And since you couldn't get bread in Asia as such, apart from Laos that had a few baguettes in certain places, but we came to love rotis in Malaysia and Thailand as our staple diet. China was the dumplings. And then Turkey we talked about.
Bananas? Bananas are something that can't go wrong until we actually stumbled across in Asia. Bananas have got stones in them, and I lost my confidence in bananas for a while. Nobody had ever warned us that bananas could have stones, and there was 12 ball bearing size stones in a very small banana.
God grief.
I mean, it's really bizarre. Yes, each place we have been through, I mean, we're talking about that we've now been in 38 countries. I mean, yes, every place had got a speciality or something that, I mean, Thailand, the first thing when you say food that comes into mind is hot food. It's not necessarily a pleasurable experience, but, you know, people say, God, the Thai food is just so wonderful and you can experience so much. And actually, Warren and I could only eat a tiny percent of the food that was available there because the rest was just too hot for us to consume. But they had a few milder dishes that were absolutely delicious, obviously fresh fruit everywhere. And when people invite you, we always try to have like local food. I mean, this is why, for instance, Turkey was so great. The food that you could get on the street, or why, for instance, Spain was so difficult for us because we couldn't get enough tapas. Tapas was for us actually just overrated, too expensive little meals. You know, cyclist needs a big meal. You know, to very specific times, and whenever we were hungry, the restaurants were actually closed or not open yet, and we found it very difficult in Spain to actually get accustomed to their lifestyle. As lovely as Spain was and as dear as the people are over there, but for the Europe trip, that was actually the hardest country for us to cycle because we couldn't get used to, we couldn't adapt to the siestas, we couldn't adapt to the their eating lifestyle and they just, you know, being out at midnight and noise levels, let's say.
Sharing the passion, appreciation, and understanding for the outdoors world.
Interesting. Well, in all the 3 years you've been travelling then, and obviously into the fourth year now, I suppose, I'm sure things have changed. Something's changed that you've experienced. And I'm just curious if there's anything immediately comes to mind. Could it be, I don't know, border crossings or the attitude between the customs in each country as you move from country to country, or the airlines or something? Has anything noticeably changed from the day you set out to where you are now?
Thinking about it this year, every country we went into, be it Turkey, be it Greece, be it former Yugoslavia, we were only there a few months ago, and they're now more difficult places to travel. So the kind of the movement, the geopolitics of moving across the land. I mean, years ago, Afghanistan would have been a relatively easy place to travel. I think what we came across this year was that politics catch you up and overtake where you are. I mean, we were in Greece, and we found our computer blocked, and that wasn't on the BBC, but it was quite definitely blocked because we could use a VPN and get out of Greece. So I think the thing from this year that has changed is that probably the politics of East-West, of freedom, of terrorism has caught us up. Us out a little bit.
Or the fear of terrorism or something like that. Yeah, I think I would agree with Warren.
Three years ago, the world felt a little bit safer. It's not, I don't imagine, but it affects how you travel.
It's that Warren has a good point there. In year one, we actually wanted to make pretty clear, or not clear, but we didn't really want to get involved in politics or the social environment of the places we get through. And that has slightly changed. We are now more emotionally involved in the places we have been through. I mean, what's, for instance, going on in the Ukraine? I mean, we haven't been there, but we have been in neighboring countries, or the things, what's going on in Turkey at the moment, or the struggle that Greece is going through, or Portugal. Those things actually have left a mark, and we seem to be more involved with the politics of these places than we have been before. And it's just taking a different view of the countries we have been to or even going into. I mean, I'm quite interested, for instance, to see when we now cross the United States, the Central Belt, how that will compare to the northern part of the United States. And the politics here have also slightly changed. You know, Obama is not the absolute, I mean, it's criticized here now more than he was 2 years ago. So, and I'm quite interested in that, how that will actually also affect our journey. It shouldn't, but in terms of interest and how people might react to certain questions, you know, that would be quite interesting.
That would be very interesting to see what the conclusion of that conversation is next time we speak. Definitely. Do you feel that coming home then, I mean, you're on the home stretch now, do you have a definite date that you're finishing and coming home? Is that going to your lives will have changed quite dramatically as a result of this trip? So what are you going to put into place in your own lifestyle?
We got an airline ticket for the 17th of August, I think. We come back to the UK. We kind of hope to do 2 months touring in Scotland. Coming back to the UK, we've got absolutely nothing planned. But that seemed to have worked for the last 3 years, not really planning too much. This is giving me quite a hard stare here. But I think if you plan, you come to a halt.
Well, the problem is because a lot of people do have that question, what will you do when you stop? And as much as we like to go back into our flat, there will be a certain task at hand, what we have to do. And I just like, you know, at the moment our flat is rented out. So do we have to redecorate the flat? Is there, you know, the practical normal things that as normal in quotation marks here, what you have to do, then there will be the whole question of what job are you going to take? I mean, I was really hoping that I would get the divine inspiration of what I'm going to do after I finish this journey, and the divine inspiration hasn't come yet. So in a way, you're looking forward going home. On the other hand, it's a bit scary because you don't know what's waiting there for you.
Well, I suppose it's interesting that it's still only, well, 4 or 5 months away, isn't it? And it's obviously already started to play in your mind. It's quite interesting that the impact that it's having, whereas I should imagine the last 2 or 3 years it's been the thing furthest from your mind.
Yeah, at one point it felt infinite. So now we've got across the USA at the moment, and we're kind of cautious about this kind of being demob happy. And we got 4,700 miles to the West Coast, which isn't a small undertaking, but we are looking ahead, already thinking about touring Scotland and coming home.
Well, that'll be interesting to actually perhaps have a chat with you when you've toured Scotland, and we could do the final conclusion as regards how it's how the home compares with everywhere else you've been, and what changes you've noticed in Scotland as well in the hospitality and people and access and whatever, you know.
Yeah, already. I mean, we've toured a little bit in Scotland, but only in 2 or 3 week periods, and we've been telling people here from memory. We've never had to carry 5 days worth of food, and we know we have to carry 5 days worth of food in Scotland. People are looking at us blankly. How could you cross continents and consider that Scotland is one of the hardest places to tour? And yet it is.
Yeah, I'd certainly got that way, and certainly from doing the TGO and walking across Scotland, certainly the commercial infrastructure has reduced quite dramatically as regards shops closing and petrol stations and that sort of thing. Anyway, let's wrap this up with the final few questions, obviously all relating to gear. We all like to talk about gear every now and again. You said you've given your gear a good hammering by the sound of it for the last 2 or 3 years, and it's still surviving well. So a few high points and low points, please.
To be honest, there's very few low points. High points, for me, my PhD 400 sleeping bag that I had it custom made because I'm slightly wide of shoulder, that has been an absolute dream. Both of our, we love our, the folding plates that you recently started to sell. We absolutely love those. Absolutely love them. We've been using those pretty almost daily for 3 years, 4 years, and the pot cozy. I took your good counsel and manufactured a pot cozy, and thank goodness I did.
It's such simple things, and you said that several times in the last interview, I understand.
Yeah, I no longer have any idea how anybody cooks without one on a single flame. They're wonderful things.
Also, the shoes, the city shoes, I don't know if you mentioned them the last time, but the city shoes that I bought in Seattle in the first year they're still with me. They have got Chinese heels now on there because the heels have worn down, so they're slightly adapted. But in terms of tops and trousers,
I think I'm trying to think now what has gone wrong. And the only thing that we've had an issue with is Downmat 7 by Exped, which is, I think we're now up to 500% failure rate. But it's such a good product, and the customer service has been so good. And they are so darn comfy that we've kept with them, we've had times where we were 2,500 miles from their service point, and they got us a new Downmat 7 for the next day, which was extraordinary.
But every mat that we had went wrong on us. I mean, we're using them almost daily. I mean, the packing and unpacking they have gone through, it's quite extraordinary. But you need equipment that you can trust, and we were seriously considering getting a big Agnes pad here and test that out, because even the mat that I just had repaired by one of the service centers, because the expert mat developed a very, very tiny hole that I couldn't see anywhere. So
that's our issue. If you're after one issue, it's Exped Downmat 7, but they are so comfortable.
Yeah.
So what's been the failure? Has it been the material or the valve leaking or just punctures that you can't find?
All the above. We've had every single possible failure with them. We were in New Zealand and the Christchurch earthquake took down their distribution centre, and they were back up and giving us a new mat out within 48 hours of the earthquake. So Customer service, absolutely second to none.
Yeah. Oh, well, at least it's good to hear the customer service has been on the ball, though, all the time. That's good,
yeah,
good
absolutely. Here. First class.
Lovely. Well, let's wind this up then. Guys, it's been lovely to talk to you again, even though it's been 2 years, 2 years since we last spoke. But I do hope people have listened to the previous podcast, because I think we've taken a different tone this time, a different route with our conversation and the content we've been talking about. But it's been fascinating to hear your thoughts and feelings and hear more about your emotions of the trip. And I shall be really interested to see, obviously, how the next 4 or 5 months goes for you, and obviously have a chat when you arrive back in good old Blighty, and we discuss how Scotland has treated you.
Yeah, but I would just say, just never put off going on a big trip. There will never be a perfect time, so if it feels even slightly right, just go and do it. You won't regret it.
My thanks to Warren and Esther once again for sharing so openly their feelings about their big trip. All links to their blog and associated images, etc., can all be found over on the Outdoor Station website. I certainly intend, if I can, to speak with them one final time when they return after hopefully a safe journey across the US back to Bonnie Scotland. And that's about it from me today. I hope you've all had a great Easter with the family and haven't consumed too many chocolate eggs. All being well, we will see some of you next weekend. So let's keep our fingers crossed for a nice, dry, warm day, very much like today as I sit here and record this. So until then, bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.